From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Jesus of Christian faith is divine, but he was also a man, a Jewish rabbi from Galilee crucified in Jerusalem. How can we, more than 2,000 years later, understand both aspects? In two new books, scholars of the New Testament, an ex-Catholic priest and a Jew, reconsider Jesus as he was during his own life, as a Jew fully part of the Jewish community. Only later were Christ's connections to Judaism diminished with huge historical consequences for interfaith relations. This hour on Point, Jesus' roots in Judaism. You can join us on air or online. Are people of all faiths ready to think differently about Jesus? Are you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is James Carroll. He's the author of 11 novels and 8 works of nonfiction, including the New York Times bestselling Constantine Sword. His new book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. For an excerpt, visit our website at onpointradio.org. James Carroll is also a former Catholic priest, a scholar in residence at Suffolk University, and a columnist for the Boston Globe. James Carroll, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much, John. Great to be here with you.
And from Nashville, Tennessee, Amy Jill Levine. She's a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and the College of Arts and Sciences. Her new book is Short Stories by Jesus, The Enigmatic Parables of a Controversial Rabbi. For an excerpt, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Amy Jill Levine, welcome back to On Point.
Delighted to be with you.
Let me start by asking both of you a question. And Amy Jill, I'll start with you. What is a popular misconception about Jesus that you hope to change with your new book?
How much time do we have?
Enough.
If we don't look at Jesus as a first century Jew who must make some sense to other Jews, we will get him wrong and we'll also get early Judaism wrong as well.
And Jim, how about you?
Well, first of all, greetings, Amy Jill. Great to be here with
you.
Nice
to be with you again.
For me, the most important thing is I want to disarm the memory of Jesus so that it completely stops being a source, a justification for violence between Christians and Jews. This crucial question of the Judaism of Jesus was really forced on the Christian imagination by the horrible reckoning that began with the Holocaust. And I think that's the context within which we should be having this conversation.
And how would you describe why the reckoning of Jesus and his Judaism was so harmful to relations between the faiths, and where do you see that relationship going?
Well, Christianity, unlike Islam, unlike other religions, defined itself positively over against the Jewish people. The positive Christian church over against the negative Jewish synagogue. And that played out in a whole range of what you might call structures of the Christian imagination, grace versus law, the past, the present versus, and the future versus the past, as something as simple and basic as the New Testament versus the Old Testament. There's a bipolar structure of the Christian imagination that has a negative portrayal of Judaism at its center. And central to that structure of the imagination is the way Christians misremembered Jesus Christ as if he were not himself Jewish, which is why Amy Jill's work is so important to recover the fundamental Jewishness of Jesus in his context and then also in the way he comes forward into history. If we can recover from the misremembered anti-Jewish Jesus, we can really begin to lay to rest the antagonism that stands between Christianity and Judaism. We've made tremendous progress after the horrified reckoning that began with the Holocaust, but we're not finished. And as Amy Gill's work shows, even something as precious to us as the parable tradition can be wrongly heard, wrongly interpreted because of this old negative, positive, bipolar structure of the Christian imagination.
Amy Gill, before I get to your work on the parables themselves, do you agree with what Jim said? And B, who fostered those structures of the imagination that he referred to, and when?
I think he's quite on target. And in part I know that because I'm an historian, and in part I know that because I spend a huge amount of time in churches, whether on Sunday morning or on Wednesday evening, and I hear from extremely well-meaning people who would not think that they have any anti-Jewish attitudes, hateful and obscene comments made about early Judaism. And the issue here is not hate, it's ignorance. Because part of that divorcing of Jesus from his Jewish context and consequently the negativizing of that context, which we've just heard about, filters down into the laity. It filters down in Sunday schools, and little Christian kids get inculcated in these unfortunate, often toxic views.
But does
so
that
the problem is there?
Did that trace to the first century? Was it in the very beginning after Jesus' time that his disciples fostered that interpretation, or did it come later?
Already its potential is there in the New Testament. Jesus was a Jew talking to other Jews, and like Jews talking to other Jews, he argued with them, and sometimes quite vociferously so. But as soon as his words become contextualized into what we call the New Testament, and the New Testament starts being read by increasingly predominantly non-Jewish readers, this internal rhetoric, which would have made sense in its own context, takes on unfortunate consequences. And that's because we've lost that historical context.
Jim, I've got to say, if structures of the imagination, I love that phrase that that you used, if those have lasted for 21 centuries, the structure must be fairly durable. What is our capacity with understanding to change them now?
Well, we're forced to change by the interruption of history that was the Holocaust. And we saw, for example, a massive change in Christian theology and attitudes symbolized by the Second Vatican Council of the Roman Catholic Church in the early 60s, which renounced what had been a kind of basic trope of the Christian mind, which was Jews are the Christ killers. And there was a tremendous step forward, a reckoning with the Holocaust, because the Christ killer charge was related to what prepared the soil for the Holocaust. And so the Council Fathers, the Catholic Church, and then other Christian denominations renounced it. But what we see in Amy Gill's work, and indeed what I hear as a Christian, as a Catholic, in sermons most Sundays of the year, is this residual sense that Jesus was opposed to his own people. And there's the issue. You see, it isn't just the Christ killer charge. It's understanding Jesus out of context as if he were not Jewish, as if he were in rebellion against his own, one word that you see in Amy Gill's book is the moribund culture of a failed Judaism. So Jesus preaches love against the revenge, or Jesus preaches openness and freedom against the rigid legalism of his Judaism.
So the Vatican II was a start, but only a start.
Yes, exactly right. It was the beginning of a reckoning. And the truth is, as you point out, this is deep in the DNA of Christianity. You might think of it as a software bug. There's a way in which Christianity's software has a foundational bug in it. How do you debug it? And you debug it overwhelmingly by, A, measuring everything we say about Jesus and believe about him against his permanent full commitment as a son of Israel to his own people. And B, we have to understand how the texts came to be written the way they are, which do include really strong invitations to see Jesus as opposed to Judaism, and B, how after the texts were written, they were even further misremembered and misread by those who came later.
And Amy Gill, I have to wonder, the subtitle of Jim's book refers to our secular age. How difficult is it to change beliefs and understandings among people of faith at a time when the secular community seems to be expanding at the expense of faith?
Well, I don't think faith is quite dead yet. You know, can things be changed in terms of the structural issues that you already pointed out? One of the brilliant effects of Constantine's sword was that people who did not know about those structures suddenly became aware of them and then suddenly began to interrogate those structures in their own teaching. So indeed, even that one book was able to change God knows how many minds. In terms of our secular age, here, the volume Christ Actually might be remarkably helpful because it can tell a secular person, you know what? Jesus is really important. And if you're not convinced by something like a virginal conception or a physical resurrection, if that comes later, fine, but pay attention to his ethics because Jesus knew what he was talking about and he's still got some extremely valuable things to tell us. And if I can say that as a Jew, how much more so could people who are nominally Christian think that Jesus was important?
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Jesus' Jewish roots and why they matter. You can join the conversation. Do you have questions for these scholars about Jesus, the Gospels, the early church? We're with James Carroll. His new book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Nuclear Age. Excuse me, for the Secular Age. He's the scholar in residence at Suffolk University. And Amy Jill Levine joins us. She's a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University. Her new book is Short Stories by Jesus, the Enigmatic Parables of a Controversial Rabbi. Jim Carroll, let me start with you. I made a slip there that there's a reason behind it when I referred to the secular age. You were influenced by your upbringing as the son of someone who was involved in America's military services at a time when nuclear war was evident and possible ever since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How has that influenced your journey to the point that you're writing this book right now?
Well, actually, this day after Veterans Day, thank you for giving me a chance to acknowledge my father, who was a military man. And in fact, he was a member, as you imply, of what you might call the nuclear priesthood. Mm-hmm. He was a director of the Defense Intelligence Agency through the 1960s. And I grew up obsessed, as many people of my generation did, with the possibility of World War III, the nuclear exchange, the ultimate destruction of human civilization. That's not unrelated to this work I've done on Jesus Christ, because my strong sense is that Hiroshima paired with Auschwitz mark a defining turn in human history. For the first time ever, we have the capacity to make ourselves extinct. We may have all had some sense that history is finite and there will come a time when it ends, but now we can bring about our own extinction, and that's different. And that has tremendous impact on every aspect of human life, especially including religious faith, which is why it is possible now to really seriously reimagine the tradition. And that's the great thing about the tradition is it gives us a basic sense of the experience believers have had in the past. But we've also learned how certain aspects of that belief can go terribly wrong. And the Holocaust shows us that. The Holocaust shows us the depth of evil to which we can descend as human beings. And Hiroshima shows us the way in which that evil can be armed now. That's what's new. So, having said all of that, it's time to seriously revise to disarm what we believe about God. The secular age is helping us do that. The secular age has called into question some basic, let's call them not sufficiently examined suppositions about the divinity, about who we worship when we say we worship God and so forth. The secular age can be a profoundly creative moment for us. Similarly, reckoning with what went wrong between Jews and Christians, overwhelmingly from the Christian side, can help us rediscover in very basic ways the tremendously hopeful not just ethic, but ongoing significance and presence for those of us who are Christians of Jesus in our lives, in the world, and in history.
Amy Jill Levine, let me ask you to just walk us through a little bit the journey that you took to get to the point that your scholarship has taken you now, both as a child, learning, hearing the Christ killer charge from other young people, to your time at Duke University, where I think we were there at the same time. I was an undergraduate there, where you said that the Divinity School was not willing to accept you as a Jew, as a scholar of the New Testament.
I grew up in Massachusetts, not too far from where your studios are, outside of New Bedford, in a neighborhood that was predominantly Portuguese Roman Catholic. So my introduction to Christianity was ethnic Roman Catholicism, and, you know, what's not to like? It was all wonderful and mystical and beautiful. And then a little girl on the school bus informed me that I had killed her Lord. And I simply could not put together how this tradition, which had such wonder and beauty, and as my parents explained to me, a Jewish man named Jesus, was saying horrible things about me. So that's how I started asking these questions. Studied religion and also studied English because I was interested always in the power of stories and how stories are interpreted differently over time for different audiences. Went to Duke and because there was a professor there named W.D. Davies who was doing the primary work on locating Christianity within its initial Jewish context. And some of the folks at the Divinity School at the time said, well, it might be highly problematic to have a Jew teach our divinity students, our future ministers, anything about the New Testament. And my initial thought was maybe they should pull the faculty, but I was told not to be fresh. The nice thing about all this was eventually I got into the New Testament classroom. I don't think one needs to be a Christian in order to appreciate Jesus, and one certainly doesn't need to be a Christian in order to locate him within his own Jewish context. So the work that I do is primarily historical work. And the other thing that I found in all this is, although it is correct that overwhelmingly there has been Christian misperception of Judaism and consequently, in unfortunate cases, Christian persecution of Jews, the misperception works in the other direction as well, so that we Jews don't know enough about Christianity, even though we live in a nation where we are overwhelmed by Christians. And we don't know the teachings of Jesus, some of which are such profound Jewish teachings. So one of the things that I can do in my scholarship is recover my own Jewish history by looking at the New Testament. Again, I don't worship Jesus as Lord and Savior, but I recognize him as a fellow Jew with really smart Jewish things to say.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Edward on the line from Braintree, Massachusetts. Edward, welcome to On Point, and go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. This question in particular is for Mr. Carroll. What do you suppose would be an appropriate apology or atonement by Christianity, and in particular the Catholic Church, for the evils that have characterized them since Christianity started? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, it's an important question. My first thought, of course, is that Pope John Paul II movingly, powerfully articulated a profound apology for the Christian sins of anti-Semitism, offenses against the Jewish people at the turn of the millennium, saying we shouldn't start a new millennium without facing this terrible failure of the Christian church. But, of course, one of the great notes of any apology that's real is that one goes on then to change what made the behavior, the offensive behavior in the first place, possible. And that's why the apology is the beginning of something, not the end of it. It's for Christians, it has to be the beginning of a serious unpacking of what led to contempt for Judaism in the first place. And that means three things. It means understanding how the anti-Jewish texts of the New Testament came to be written that way, which means every Christian has to take on a much fuller responsibility for critical knowledge of the Bible. Must get much more historically and critically sensitive to how the Bible came to be. So most obviously, for example, the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are not eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus. They were not written by people who knew Jesus personally or who were with him on the road. the Gospels were written between 70 and 100, scholars pretty much are unanimous in saying that, roughly in those years, which, of course, is almost two full generations after the death of Jesus.
So they were derivative
accounts. In the year 30. Well, they're accounts written down that are drawing on oral traditions that began during and after the lifetime of Jesus. But they're not eyewitness accounts, which is crucial. So that, for example, when Pontius Pilate is rendered in the gospel as a man of tender conscience who affirms the innocence of Jesus and is shown being forced into crucifying Jesus, even though he doesn't want to, being forced by a hostile Jewish crowd, we have to understand that's not an account that was journalistic. It's not true to the way things happened. Pontius Pilate, we know from other sources, was not a man of tender conscience. He was a brutal tyrant. So what happened? How did that get to be written that way? It's a huge and crucial question. And the short answer is the Gospels were written during a period of savage Roman war, and which sparked what you could call a civil war among groups of Jews. And what the Gospels are is a record of one side of that contention among the Jewish people.
Amy Jill, Jim described Pope John Paul as setting off on the beginning of a reconciliation apology of a process. If that's correct, what does Pope Francis represent in that process? What do you expect from him?
Pope Francis has certainly changed the attitude within general perceptions of what official Catholicism is, and I think that's all to the good, that the Church should be open and welcoming and a little bit less judgmental and a little bit more compassionate. Terrific. In terms of apologies, I'm not terribly interested in contemporary Christians or more specifically Catholics apologizing to me. The contemporary Catholic has not done something to me. What was done primarily to my ancestors. So rather than fuss about questions of apology, I'd much rather look at what we can do to make sure that bad things do not continue to happen. And here I think Jim Carroll's comment about education and knowing the history is exceptionally important. Go back and understand Judaism at the time of Jesus. Understand the political situation, the economic situation, the role of women, the role of the sense of divine justice and how it played out in daily life. And we'll be much better equipped to understand why the New Testament was made in the first place, as well as how we might use it today.
All right, let's go to another call. We've got John on the line from Austin, Texas. John, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I had read somewhere that, you know, the early Christians, the very, very early Christians, were kind of split in their attitude. Some viewed Christianity, per se, as really kind of an offshoot or a sect or a group within Judaism, and were very protective about keeping it a Jewish movement, whereas others, were more desirous of trying to preach the message to the non-Jewish population, and that the seeds for this discord, you know, began almost immediately with these two groups, and it was only when people began to realize that if it remained just a Jewish sect, that it had no legs for, you know, long-term growth, you know, throughout the Mediterranean. Is this an accurate depiction, or am I getting something wrong here?
Jim Carroll?
Well, greetings, John. I wouldn't say you've got it wrong, but I would suggest a slightly different slant to all that you just said. And the first point to make, of course, is that all of the early so-called Christians were Jews. The Jesus movement was a Jewish movement. The people in the movement, for most powerful example, St. Paul, understood the meaning of Jesus in Jewish terms as the ushering in of the end time. And one of the common experiences that Jews had of what end time hope involved was the time of welcoming others into the people of Israel. And you see that in St. Paul, which motivates him to telling the story of Jesus, a Jewish story, outside the strict confines of Judaism. And yes, he was so-called the apostle to the Gentiles. He was always Jewish and always understood himself as preaching a Jewish message. Jesus, the end time, all people are brought into the worship of the one God of Israel. Now, that morphed because of contingent historical factors, especially that Roman war, which in the year 135 destroyed Jerusalem, which was the center of Jewish Christian belief, therefore opening the way to dominance of the movement by Gentiles who did not understand its Jewishness. And once Gentiles dominated the Christian movement, it was easy for them to misread the texts and to forget that Jesus was not one of them, but was fully and permanently Jewish.
Fascinating turn in the road there.
Yes, and the turn in the road, to emphasize it, was a result of the Roman War.
Let's go to another call. We've got Jennifer on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hello. I just have a comment, actually, more than a question. I received a Master of Theological Studies degree from Vanderbilt back in 2003, and I was one of Dr. Levine's students, only for LRF. Hi, AJ.
Hi.
And, I'm certain you don't remember me. I'm a Catholic convert, and I primarily studied with Patu Burns. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to say that the course that I took with you actually changed the emphasis of my studies, because I was initially interested in the Reformation era, mostly because I was raised Southern Baptist. And once I took your course, I began to be interested in that transition of early Christianity and how things, the historical context. And I've always been frustrated at how little of the record we still have, but I felt like I really gained some valuable knowledge from your course. And
Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. AJ, that's got to be pretty satisfying for you to hear from a student like that.
That's just fantastic. Thank you. What Jennifer flagged here is a problem, I think, also in theological education, is that I don't think ministers today are being sufficiently trained to address the Jewish context of the New Testament. They are certainly not being trained to address how to avoid anti-Jewish teaching and preaching. And because they don't have that information, they're in no position to inform their Sunday school teachers or parochial school teachers.
Why aren't they trained?
That stuff simply continues. The Association of Theological Schools, which is the major accrediting organization for many divinity schools and seminaries, does not require targeted instruction on avoiding anti-Jewish teaching and preaching, and they have their own pedagogical reasons for doing that. In a number of cases, faculty think that the information will be conveyed by different faculty members. So the New Testament professor thinks it will be conveyed by the fellows who teach preaching, who teach homiletics, and they think it will be conveyed by the ethicist, or they hope it will get picked up in some elective course in Jewish-Christian relations. So it typically falls through the cracks.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. You can join the conversation. How is the historical Jesus important for Christianity today? Do you welcome the new tone Pope Francis is setting for the Catholic Church? We're with James Carroll. His new book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. He's the scholar in residence at Suffolk University. And Amy Jill Levine joins us. She's a professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt University. Her new book is Short Stories by Jesus, The Enigmatic Parables of a Controversial Rabbi. And Amy Jill, I want to start with your book. You describe new ways of looking at the parables, distinguishing them from Hallmark cards or other anodyne kind of be nice prescriptions. And one particularly provocative one, which I think was intentionally provocative on your part, you said the parable of the Good Samaritan might as well be called, if we were trying to convey what it conveyed at the time, the good rapist or the good Osama bin Laden. Explain.
Pretty much so. What I'm trying to do is actually not come up with new readings. I'm trying to recover the original ones, the oldest ones, or the ones that Jesus' first century audience, a group of Jews, would have taken from them. Today, very frequently, the Good Samaritan is looked at as having the message, we should appreciate other people who are the contemporary oppressed people on the block, and then whatever category in which we have. So the person without a green card, the person who's on parole, the person who's HIV positive, the person of the alternative ethnic or racial makeup to the majority. But that's not what first century Jews would hear. First century Jews would recognize Samaritans not as the oppressed minority. They're actually the enemy next door. And the Gospel of Luke, because Luke's a brilliant writer, actually tells us this, because one chapter before the Good Samaritan, Luke explains how Jesus is going through Samaria, and the Samaritans simply refuse him hospitality because he's a Jew, and he's heading toward Jerusalem. Jews and Samaritans hold nothing in common. The Gospel of John tells us that. And if we go back and we look at earlier treatments of Samaria in the scriptures of Israel, what the church calls the Old Testament and the synagogue calls the Tanakh, then it is in locations like Samaria where rape occurs, where murder occurs. If I'm that person in the ditch and I see that Samaritan coming toward me, I might rather die than acknowledge that somebody like that, one of those people, could actually be the one responsible for saving my life.
All right, let's go to another call. We've got Stephanie on the line from Springfield, Illinois. Stephanie, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I'm calling. I'm interested in this conversation. I grew up in a strong Protestant Christian home and attended Christian elementary school and high school, and we studied scriptures in school and in church. And I find it interesting. I never once heard of Jews referred to as Christ killers until I was in college and was in a class and was told that that was the case. And I think it for at least in the Protestant tradition, the understanding as we studied is people were used to fulfill God's purpose, which was for his son to sacrifice himself. And so we didn't see it so much as, oh, the Jews were horrible Christ killers, but they were fulfilling God's purpose of sacrificing his son. And if anything, in the churches that I grew up in, they're very protective of the Jewish, the Jewish people, because they see them as that's where Christ came from. So I'm enjoying this, but that was not my experience, and I was exposed to a lot of different Protestant churches in my growing up years. So,
Stephanie, thanks so much for your call. Jim Carroll, does Stephanie signal to us that maybe our cultural understanding has changed more than we may think?
Well, I would salute Stephanie for putting her experience before us, and it helps us to emphasize that in her lifetime, and I'm presuming she's a post-World War II person, in her lifetime there's been a profound shift in the way Christians generally think about such things as the Christ killer charge. That, thank goodness, has been essentially left behind mostly, although a fairly strong minority of Christians still are at the mercy of this old slander. But Stephanie's positive experience is important, and it's true for many, many younger people now, which is one of the important aspects of the Catholic Vatican Council denunciation. Rejection of the Christ killer charge. Let me just observe in Stephanie's drawing the distinction between Protestant and Catholic experience. I wouldn't ever want to be understood as saying the Catholic Church is particularly venal in this history. No, no. Nor is the Protestant Church particularly innocent. The history's most vile anti-Semitic screeds, perhaps, alas, were written by Martin Luther. The profound anti-Jewish sense that German Lutheranism tapped into the psyche of the German nation just as it was coming into being in the late Middle Ages is a part of the story of Nazi anti-Semitism. So the whole Christian church has reckoning to do with this history.
Amy Jill, do you suspect that the understanding that we're discussing, or lack of it, is significantly different in the South, where you now live and work, as compared to, say, the Northeast, where Jim Carroll works and where you grew up?
I actually don't think so, and that's because I've been around the country, and what I get is a fair balance. So that the stereotype of the South is as being, you know, fundamentalist Protestant and anti-intellectual is just it's just a false stereotype. To go back to Stephanie's comment, it is because I think of the work of Vatican II, the work of the Roman Catholic Church to undo some of the negative teachings about Judaism, to undo the idea that all Jews at all times and places are responsible for the death of Jesus. It is precisely because the Catholic Church stepped forward that Protestant churches then followed in the wake. I think the Catholic Church actually doesn't get enough credit for undoing some of the damage. I don't often hear Jewish Christ killer. That really seems to have receded. What I do continue to hear is negative stereotypings of Judaism and then Jesus set over above them. So Judaism epitomizes misogyny. They make the Taliban look progressive. And then Jesus comes in and invents feminism. Or Jews think that if you're rich, God loves you, and Jesus says God loves you if you're poor. I mean, anybody who thinks that has obviously not read the scriptures of Israel.
Jim Carroll, jump in here.
Well, I just want to observe, we've referred to Pope Francis, two things about Pope Francis. One, the progress we've made, and two, the journey we have yet to make. Pope Francis said almost offhandedly a few months ago that the world can never be grateful enough. I'm paraphrasing, but almost accurate here. The world can never be grateful enough to the Jewish people for their faithfulness to God. Now, that's a long way from being sort of merely tolerant of he's saying we can't be grateful enough and for a faithfulness which down through the centuries was itself defined as heresy and as wrong, for which Jews were condemned for what they were condemned for before. Pope Francis offhandedly says we can never be grateful enough for now. But at the same time, I'm almost certain I can remember Pope Francis using the reference to the Pharisees in the way Christians almost always do as a synonym for hypocrite. And it's a small way – the language itself suggests the problem here. Pharisees in the time of Jesus were not hypocrites. Jesus may have in his historical context been in contention with groups of fellow Jews, including perhaps the Pharisees, but to think that Jesus would have slandered the Pharisees with the broad brush that the Christian imagination does now is simply wrong.
Let's go to another call. We've got Brent on the line from Akron, Ohio. Brent, welcome to On Point. Go ahead.
Hi, John. I just wanted to make the point that I think there's probably a fairly high probability that it's impossible to rip anti-Semitism out of the DNA of Christianity, that it's more central. It's not a sideline. And especially evangelical or those branches of Christianity that believe in the literal accuracy of the New Testament. So that's my point.
Brent, what is your faith?
I'm Jewish.
Well, thanks so much for your call. Amy Jill, as a Jew yourself, do you also feel that anti-Semitism cannot be ripped from the DNA of Christianity?
I would take that as a bit strong. The reason I would take it as too strong is because I've seen countless students in here, Jennifer, who called in earlier, might be an example, of students, of clergy, of religious educators who are aware of the problem and then keep an eye on it. It may be hardwired in us like racism is hardwired in us and classism and ethnocentrism. Human beings are replete with various ills, with various sins. But I think we can keep them in check, and I think for a number of us, I think we can recover from this. But it requires a lot of work on our part.
All right, let's take another call. Harry is on the line from Farmington, Connecticut. Harry, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. During the formation of the early church, the first few hundred years, obviously there were compelling arguments towards the expansion of the church. During that same period of discussion and argumentation, what were the parallel arguments leading to reaffirmation of Judaism?
Thanks so much for your call, Harry. Jim Carroll?
That's a great question because it helps us remember that in the first two or three centuries of the Christian world, the hard and fast distinction between Judaism and Christianity that we take for granted today simply didn't exist yet. There were Jesus people who observed Shabbat and kosher and studied Torah, and there were Jewish people who having observed Sabbath on Saturday, also shared the Eucharistic meal on Sunday. They were mixing and matching and crossing of boundaries that was almost impossible for us today to imagine. It was really in the early 4th century that the radical distinction between Judaism and Christianity was made permanent, and that again, historical accident. The Roman emperor became a Catholic. Constantine in the early 4th century becomes a Catholic. More to the point, the Roman Empire effectively becomes the church, and its upholding of boundaries and its necessary for organizational purposes, declaring a creed, hard and fast set of beliefs, and declaring hard and fast notions of membership. The next thing you know, Jews and Christians were increasingly radically separated. And by the end of the 4th century, the separation, the parting of the ways was complete. But the reason those early centuries are instructive to us now, and this goes to the question of DNA, it does suggest another way. Christianity and Judaism are separate religions now, and there is no... This is not about Christians finding another way to bring Jews into the fold. But as separate religions, we can be much more respectful of each other. And we can be much more respectful of each other as having revelations from the one God of Israel.
Well, to that point, Amy Jill, I want to ask you about something that Jim mentioned earlier, a few minutes ago, about stereotypes about attitudes within the faith toward wealth and poverty. I wonder if you could unpack a little bit what your research has told you about the parable of the rich man and Lazarus.
It certainly functions as a cautionary tale that if you are wealthy, if you are self-indulgent, if you engage in conspicuous consumerism, which is the best way of describing the rich man in this parable in the Gospel of Luke, and there's a poor person whose name you even know by your gait, and you do nothing, that there should be some sort of reckoning. Whether Lazarus is placed, he's in the high rent heavenly district. He's in what's called the bosom of Abraham or the breast of Abraham. Whether he's there simply because he was poor and God said, at some point, you two need to have your fill, or whether he did something righteous, we simply don't know. The beginning of the Gospel of Luke, Mary's Magnificat, which would be, I think, particularly appreciated by Catholic listeners, goes on to say that the time will come when the mighty are pulled down from the thrones and the poor are lifted up and the hungry will be fed and the people who overindulge will be sent away. As if the text says, you know, at some point there might be a reckoning, and at the same time says, whatever that reckoning is, it will not come about by people who proclaim violent revolution. It will come about because people's values have to be reconfigured.
Jim Carroll, I want to ask you, as you're both scholars who are familiar with each other's work, respect each other clearly, but do you think of your views and your analytical approach to Jesus as identical to that of Amy Jill, or do you see distinctions between how you see it?
Well, Amy Jill, early in the conversation, lifted up the ongoing importance of the ethic of Jesus. And she's right about that, and it's valuable. But I'm a believing Christian, and Jesus means more to me than that. And I'm sure Amy Jill would understand that. Jesus is, for me, the Son of God, present in my life. We Catholics refer to the real presence, the sacramental imagination of Christianity gives me a way to be in touch with God through Jesus Christ. And that's a distinction that must always be affirmed between Jews and Christians when they're engaged in interfaith dialogue, and must be always understood as profoundly separating. But it's the ground of commonality is to return to this basic sense of who Jesus himself is.
Exactly.
Was.
Well, Amy Jill, how about from your perspective, apart from your personal faith, do you read Jim's work and say, I like it, but I disagree with that interpretation or this interpretation?
I think Jim is quite correct. I'm a Jew. I don't worship Jesus as Lord and Savior. He's a Christian. He does. But this is not based in academics. Religious faith is not an academic concern. Religious faith is not like a Sudoku that if you're simply smart enough, you could get all the numbers in the right boxes. Religious faith is like love. It comes from your heart. It doesn't come from your head.
Well, that's why I'm asking about historical interpretation, if your historical interpretations are the same.
No two historians are going to agree fully. What makes the historical enterprise of interest is we can then have conversations about changing nuances here or there.
Amy Jill Levine, her new book is Short Stories by Jesus, The Enigmatic Parables of a Controversial Rabbi. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And James Carroll, his new book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, a 3-star general on why we lost the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm John Harwood, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.